Hey, Pioneers, welcome to episode number 427. Today's episode, we are going to be diving into talking about ways beyond buying feed from the feed store or conventional ways of feeding your livestock. So if you are looking for ways to get away from the feed store, to be more self-sufficient or sustainable with your feed, as well as lowering your feed costs, including looking at historical ways that people fed their animals very nutritiously and very well when there were no large feed stores, then you are going to love today's episode. Today's episode, we are interviewing Deanne Converse. She is a native of the Northwest and is passionate about sharing how to grow and feed livestock top-notch nutritious food that anyone can sustainably produce on any scale. So we shouldn't have to be caught up in choosing to raise livestock or not because of the cost or quality of available commercial feeds, or if hay doesn't fit into your budget, especially if you listened to my episode last week, episode number 426, where we were talking about beef cattle and the way that hay prices have increased dramatically over the past few years, then you are going to adore today's topic. And we're not only talking about ways to feed cattle, but as well as chicken and all different types of livestock. So I found this episode fascinating, and you will be able to go to the blog post that accompanies this episode, which will have, if you're watching this on YouTube, welcome. It'll be right beneath the video in the video description, or if you're listening to this old-fashioned way, which is how I usually listen to podcasts on my phone. Isn't that funny to say listening to something on my phone in the context of old-fashioned, but you get what I mean. So we will have links to some of the different places where you can order some of the different crops that we're going to be talking about that you may look at replacing or using in addition to hay and different things like that. So you can find that by going to melissaknorris.com/427, because this is episode number 427. And today's podcast episode is sponsored by the Modern Homesteading Conference, where Dee will be presenting at, as well as myself. Temple Grandin is going to be there, who, if you are not familiar with Temple's story, oh my goodness, that is one that you're going to want to watch her documentary, get familiar with. Her contributions to animal husbandry, and especially the way that we humanely treat animals, cattle, as well as her work in the field of autism, is just inspiring. So you're not going to want to miss the opportunity to learn from her in person. All of that and more is going to be at the Modern Homesteading Conference in Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, this June 28th and 29th. Go to modernhomesteading.com. and grab your tickets. Cannot wait to see you there. And without further ado, we are going to dive straight into this interview with Dee. Well, Dee, I am super excited for today's podcast. So welcome to the Pioneering Today podcast.
Glad to be here.
Yeah. So I am just ready to jump into this topic. I know it's something that a lot of people are going to be interested in, and it's probably not as widely talked about within homesteading and livestock. So let's just start very basic, and then we're going to grow from there. So what is fodder, the definition, and then how is that different from foraging in regards to feeding livestock?
Well, in regards to feeding livestock, fodder would be what you would grow or find and cut and bring and present to your livestock as feed. And then forage is basically just letting your animals go out and find what you have there, whether you've planted it there purposely or whether it happens to already be where they're living. That's pretty much the basic difference between fodder and foraging. I know there's different terms on times that fodder is used in different terminology. And even when we were talking prior, there was some confusion because I wasn't sure whether you were talking about growing the microgreen type fodder for animals, which is also another type of fodder. So that's a good clarification to begin with, that we're talking about any fresh food that we would present to our animals for feed, or even ensiled food that we would present to our animals for feed would be fodder.
Okay. So when we're talking about hay, that is or is not a type of fodder, that, because obviously that's something that's being cut and delivered to them.
Right. That would be considered a fodder, a type of fodder, as opposed to a forage, which is something that the animals are going out and getting themselves. If that if that helps in the definition there, as far as what we're going to be talking about today.
Yeah, no, it definitely does. So for a lot of people, it's not feasible for them to grow their own hay or necessarily other grains in quantity to be able to feed their livestock. So a lot of folks are looking for alternative ways to feed their animals. I mean, we're seeing, you know, prices rising in my area. We in the wintertime for our cattle feed hay, and our hay costs in the last 5 years have tripled for the same, for the same tonnage, etc. And so thankfully I'm like keeping my fingers crossed. It feels like it's stabilized. What last year's prices were are looking like they'll be this year's prices. Hallelujah. However, that has been a really large increase in cost, obviously, within a short period of time. So I know other people are feeling this pinch as well. So when we're talking about a fodder system, I think a lot of folks have in their mind more of a seed sprouting system. And, and you just mentioned previously that the kind of more the microgreens. So is this a good option, doing the seed sprouting system, or are there other methods that can still create nutrient dense feed for our animals using obviously the definition of fodder?
That's actually an excellent question. And in fact, we used to raise goats and we trained them and sold them as pack stock. And we actually had to give that up years ago because the cost of hay, and this was way back, you know, when dirt was new, when we were trying to run a budget and we just couldn't afford to feed our goats the hay that they needed. So we, you know, we know what the pinch is like these days. So then I actually started growing fodder in the trays. And this was after we actually got rid of our goats. I finally found out about it. We were feeding our pigs and our chickens sprouted grains. And what you do is you soak your grains. It would be barley, wheat, it could be buckwheat, peas, or sunflowers. And you just soak them overnight, and then you put them in a growing tray, you know, at about a half inch thick. And then they have to be rinsed once or twice a day. And then you just grow them, and you can grow them indoors in wintertime. And this actually is a viable way to feed a nutrient dense feed to your livestock. And it doesn't actually have to take a lot of room. I did it in my kitchen. I've done it in my back porch. I've done it in a little portable greenhouse outside. The problem being right now is that the same as with hay, the seed is feed seed is what you would be using is going way, way high. So economically speaking, it used to be that yes, this was actually much more economical than buying your concentrates for your animals. And it was would be competitive with the cost of hay. There we go. Got the word. And so for someone who doesn't have pasturage or who can't afford hay or doesn't have storage for hay, that's a viable option. But even now, when we have those droughts so that there is not the hay available, well, the seed to grow that fodder has to come from the hay, the heads off of your wheat, off of your barley. So that's not even necessarily available in a lot of areas, and the price is going up. So if in your area you can get seed at a reasonable price, yes, that's a viable option. But really and truly, doing the math right now, it doesn't cut the mustard as far as I'm concerned, as far as being an economic way to go, especially if you're feeding anything in volume. You know, you've got more than a few rabbits, more than a few chickens, ducks. But certainly I do actually keep feed seed here, and I do grow the occasional wheat and barley and peas and sunflowers for my livestock. But it is not a mainstream fall because it's just not economically viable.
Yeah.
Okay, so and that it just was the first part.
Go ahead. Yeah, I was going to say, and for this, because I know a lot of people will ferment their feed, especially like chicken feed, et cetera, and do this, but we're talking about actually letting those seeds grow into little sprouts, like baby little microgreens. So it's the step beyond fermenting
Exactly.
For actually growing these out, just for clarification there.
That's a really good clarification. And in fact, what you're doing is you're growing the grass if it was barley or if it were wheat, you're growing it to the short grass stage. It's still actually living off of the energy found in the seeds. So you're not depleting the energy or the nutrients that's found in there. And now when you're growing your sunflowers or your pea shoots, the same thing. But actually what I do with mine, I compost all my manures on my farm, and I do worm composting. So I've got a completely clean, high powered, basically growing medium. And I put a thin layer of that underneath my pea shoots and my sunflowers so that they grow better. And actually they make great pesto if you sneak them for your own salads and stuff. But it allows a longer time for them to grow, and they're not depleting the nutrients. But yes, it is just the short stage. It's not sprouts, it's not fermenting, which are all good choices. But this is actually growing to the short grass stage, so to speak, about 4 or 6 inches at the maximum for the grasses.
Okay, awesome. Sorry, I just wanted to interject there. And then on to
part
good.
Two. Okay. So then you wanted to know about if there's other options about for your, highly nutrient choices for feed. And that's one of the things that a lot of people just don't hear about. And having done a lot of research, because, we're running on a budget too. And so in some of the work that we've done over internationally, I found out about different options, things like azolla. It's a tiny water plant that we'll talk a little bit about whenever it is you want me to dive into that, the particulars. There is growing sweet potatoes, which for the vine, we can actually do that clear north here. And it's really easy to do. You can even make your yard look beautiful doing it. You can even shade a barn doing it. It's amazing what it can do. And you can ensile the sweet potato vines. There is mangel beets, which I know for you with your herd of cattle, this would be an incredible source. But the mangel beets are actually a historic feed source, a crop that had been very, very important clear back in the Roman times. But up until the 1950s, it was still used. And then when things became mechanized, people didn't grow beets for feed anymore. But the mangel beets themselves can grow up to 20 to 30 pounds each. It's and highly nutritious. You can grow 500 pounds of feed in terms of mangel beets in a 100-foot row. So in terms of space and getting a high output of feed, that is something that a lot of people should sit up and pay attention to. And it keeps all winter long, so there's your winter feed. And you can actually get greens off it by just, when you store yours, you can your beets, you can expose them to a little bit of light and they'll start growing their green tops again. So then you can hack them off for your salad or feed them to your animals. So it's a really good option. So there's that. There's sunflowers, black oil sunflowers are a really good high-powered feed option, as well as amaranth, which is another good one. In terms of something that's right on hand that anyone can use, tree hay, tree fodder, excellent. And that's an option that a lot of people don't even realize is viable for animal feed. In fact, in terms of, about 3 years ago, we had a drought out here and there was hay went skyrocketed and it was hard to find, really hard to find, at least at a decent price. You've got viable top-notch feed up in the trees, those leaves that are growing even during drought times. And so you can actually drought-proof your farm just by growing the right trees and learning how to manage them so that they will constantly give you either fresh fodder if you just want to feed it to them fresh, or whether you want to harvest the branches and manage them so that you can bring your branches in and dry them for hay. And so if we can go into those details in a little bit too. So yeah, there's quite a few options. I teach an 8-hour class over many, many more options. So we're going to, just fit some of the top ones in today.
Yeah, I'm excited. And you're going to be talking again this year at the Modern Homesteading Conference about this subject too. So lots of opportunities to learn. One of the things I want to ask, especially for those of us who live in a northern climate, which I know you're the same as me, we're in the northern climate. I know we're coming out of winter, but as I, you know, plan all of my crops for the coming year, I always have, you know, in my mind, like, what is for fresh eating now for both ourselves, but also the animals? And then, of course, what am I going to be putting up for winter or trying to winterize as far as crops go? The mango beets, because they're so big, like those I would probably just leave in the ground here and just mulch them really well, which that is one of my favorite methods, because having storage space, you know, there's only so much barn space. There's only so much that. Right. So if there's any type of crop that I can just kind of get where it's at, I love doing that. So I'm going to be looking into getting some mango beet seed. That's not one that we've done before, but I'm super intrigued. But for the cold climates in winter, are there any methods specifically that work really well? Because for most folks, that's when the forage is at the least and they're needing to supplement the most.
What are you talking about as far as, you mean as far as what you can grow or what you're feeding in the wintertime?
Great clarification. I would say one, if there's any that can grow for the winter climates, or that we're doing in as a fall crop, you know, that would come to harvestable size right as we're going into winter, that like the mango beet, then you'd be able to, you know, store over winter and feed during winter fairly easily.
Well, one of the things that I would recommend as far as the mango beets, if you can, you can keep them in the ground, but they have to be very well mulched, because you don't want them to freeze. If they freeze thaw, they are going to rot. But one of the management ways that people handle them, because of course, like you say, where's the storage space for it, is if you want to actually lift them out of the ground and you can dig a hole that you can line with a tarp and just cover them so that they're able to be pulled out. They don't actually have to be in a barn. They just need to be somewhere where they won't freeze and thaw. And, you know, in terms of feeding, you know, especially where you are, where we are, you know, in the wintertime, if you've got, you know, 4 feet of snow with ice on top, do you really want to dig it out? And so that's why you want to put in some place that's convenient to get. And that can easily be someplace that you've covered, that you can just pull the mulch off the top or a tarp off the top and throw them out. For mango beets, one thing that needs to be remembered is that they need to be stored somewhere for 3 months. So if you harvest them in the, like up in around October, November, say close to January is when you want to start feeding them out. And the reason for that is that they need to go through a sugar conversion before you present them to your animals, or you could easily end up with scours, and scours in cows is pretty gross.
Yes. Yeah. So it's not desirable. That. Yeah.
Yeah. So what historically was done is that you can grow them as a fall crop, and then they come to that point where you want to harvest them. But actually, if you're talking about what you want to harvest and present to your animals, carrots and turnips and rutabagas were the other historic crop that went with those three. It was carrots, rutabagas, turnips, and mango beets. And so what happened is, because turnips don't store as well, what they would do is it would grow those and let your animals feed over the top of those in the fall. So your grass is already dead, but the turnip is a really cold hardy crop. So you can actually, wherever you've grown them, you can just turn your cattle in there and they'll graze over the top of those. And actually even the tops will grow back and they'll eat the turnips themselves. It's actually a good management strategy for improving pasture too, because a lot of people will put grow turnips out in their pastures to increase the nutrients in their soil. Same with rutabagas. You can do the same thing with the rutabagas. So what you would do is you would grow your turnips and feed those out first while the mango beets are aging. Then the mango beets would be fed next. And then any carrots that you grew, because carrots keep longer in cold storage, or you can store them in the ground. I mean, you've probably done the same thing. And just yank them out of the ground when you want to feed them. So you can interplant any of that stuff. Those are some really good crops for winter feed. But the other thing that is a really good winter feed is if you grow sweet potatoes during the summertime, and we're growing them for the vine, not for the potato. So just consider the potato a serendipity. If you like them, they're great human food. But you can use them for, I mean, they're good for dogs too, for that matter, if they're cooked. But what you would do is grow the sweet potatoes, and you can feed fresh to all of your animals, horses, pigs, rabbits, chickens, cattle, any of your ruminants actually, and sheep. But the extra, what you would do is you would ensile them. And so
what is ensile?
That means making silage out of them, you know? So is basically it's like if you've ever done fermented vegetables, that's kind of what you're going to be doing with your vines. But what you would do is you would take, say, a barrel. In third world countries, this is commonly done, but they actually will dig a hole and line it with a tarp because, you know, you use what you've got. And then you put sugar in them. And actually, if you were to layer them with mangel beet, because mangel beet is high in sugar, in fact, you can make sugar out of mangel beets, then you would layer between, or you can add dry molasses, you get that livestock molasses, and put that in there as well, and just layer your vines and some sweetness vines or whatever you have for sweetness, and then cover it over so there's no oxygen in it. It will actually ferment, and you've got a highly nutritious ensiled food for your livestock, and it'll last all winter long. So you've got several different options for high quality feed, and you can
No, I'm super excited about that part. We do haylage, so obviously it's the fermented hay. Mm-hmm. But I love the idea of this creating a large ferment with the vines because of its ability to store all winter. Because otherwise those vines, unless, I don't know if you've ever tried drying them, obviously I haven't, but that seems like a very viable way in order to keep it all winter.
Yeah, there's a high water content in them, so drying them is a little difficult. And actually, for a home fare, people don't realize this, but the sweet potatoes, and I'm talking about Empumoea batatas, not regular potatoes. They're not in the nightshade family. You can actually grow them indoors, like hanging over a banister off of a ledge, and in your house, have a beautiful viney house plant, and cut those off and feed them to your rabbits or your family. Because if you take the leaves and you cook them with garlic and butter or onions, it's really healthful fare for your family. But they're just an amazing thing that you can grow. If you don't have a lot of room and you want to grow something for your livestock, put a potted plant hanging from the eaves in your house, and let that drape on down along with your nasturtiums or whatever other beautiful thing you've got growing. And you've got cascading feed that's growing for your livestock. Same thing over if you've got a barn outside that tends to be really hot. Put a 18 gallon bin on the top of your barn or whatever shed it is. Put your sweet potatoes on the top and let them grow and cascade down. They'll shade your barn, and you can cut them off and feed them and throw them to your chickens, or save them for ensiling, or feed them to your cows or your goats. So highly productive.
Yes. And you're right. They are beautiful. Like, you'll see planters often just in, like, you know, regular commercial nurseries and whatever, that have the sweet potato vines just for the pleasing aesthetic. So
any of the decorative ones, as long as it says Empumoea batatas, those decorative ones are fair for animals as well. So you're right. You can make a very beautiful yard.
Yeah. Okay. I'm excited because I have plenty of time at the time of this recording to be able to get those sweet potato vines going this summer, and then maybe save some of them and just transfer them indoors in the fall once we hit those cooler temps. So yeah, this is exciting. Okay. Sorry. I think I keep cutting you off because I'm like, ooh.
That's quite all right.
Yeah. Great. I would love to get into details on some tree fodder, but also, as far as a lot of what we've talked about so far is really universal, can be used. You've said rabbits, chickens, cattle, goats. However, as we're looking at our different livestock, do you have some top favorites when it comes to species specific, or are most of them really going to work for, you know, all your different, your ruminants, and then obviously your herbivores, your poultry?
Pretty much everything that I try to deal with is pretty pretty well, it goes over everything as much as I possibly can. But when it comes to tree fodder, of course, there are some cautions that you want to keep in mind as far as what you would present to an animal. But let's see, for me, the easiest thing is growing the azolla. And I grow that in kiddie pools because I can manage it that way. And it just keeps growing and growing and growing. I'm real big on getting things started and just letting it do its thing. You know, the least I have to do to feed the animals or to get the food ready for the animals, the better. So I just put the kiddie pools by the chicken coop, and I just take one of those little scoopy net thingies and scoop it off the top and throw it into my chickens, quails, and ducks. And it's also great for rabbits. So I prefer using that the azolla for the smaller livestock, although it is really, really good for your larger livestock, your ruminants. In fact, it actually increases the milk production for cattle, and so it, you know, it's something to keep in mind. But
what is exactly azolla for those who haven't heard the term or aren't sure even what it is? Can you go into a little bit specific?
Yeah. Yeah. And in fact, if you've ever seen, a lot of people confuse azolla and duckweed. So I'm just going to kind of describe the both of them, and I'm sure everybody will recognize this. If you've ever seen a National Geographic show where an alligator comes up out of the swamp and it's covered in this green little dotty stuff on it, normally that's duckweed. But there's also a plant that grows right along beside it that a lot of people might not recognize, and it looks like a little fern. And it's just, it fits right on the top of your fingernails, and it's just a floating fern. And it's what we're looking for in this area. Its scientific name is Azolla caroliniana is what we would want. You can feed duckweed and azolla grow together really well. The only reason I don't recommend or promote the duckweed as much as in some areas of the United States, it's actually illegal to grow it. But azolla is okay to grow anywhere in the United States. Okay. And as far as I know, duckweed is not illegal to grow in Washington, Idaho, Montana, and California, as far as transporting it and that kind of thing. But because you've got a wide listening group here, I just want to make that clarification there. But azolla, it floats right on the top of the surface of the water, and it's teeny tiny, about the size of your thumbnail, and it reproduces incredibly. It does vegetative cloning, and it doubles its volume in 24 to 48 hours. This is fantastic. So you've got this azolla here. There we go. Whoop, there we go. And it's got some fronds, and it will have a little daughter frond off to the side here, and it'll just break away, and it has little rootlets that hang out from underneath it. And pretty soon you've got another one and another one and another one and another one. So I just throw them on top of the water in a kiddie pool. I actually add, a lot of people use, like in third world countries, is a big feed, and they put cow manure in it. Well, I don't recommend that simply because I want a clean feed for my animals because, you know, of course, bacteria and worms and those kind of things. So I use my worm castings because worm castings are completely clean. And so once any of the manures have gone through the gut of my worms, I've got this completely clean, highly nutritious food source. I throw that in my water, put the azolla over the top, and it just grows great guns. And so all I do is I scoop the azolla off the top of the water, and I've got a handful of it, and I can take it to my chickens. By the next day, you can't even tell I took it off the top of the water. It grows that fast.
Yeah, I could see why it could probably be invasive, though, introduced into natural water sources, which is probably why the duckweed is illegal, I'm assuming, in certain areas.
Duckweed is because duckweed, well, Azolla caroliniana is actually native to this area. Okay. It's just very rarely that you would find it. And the same with duckweed, but you are right. And that's why I never recommend putting it in, like if you've got a pond, don't put it in a pond because you just don't know if a raccoon's going to go in there and run over to the next source of water, and away we go. We want to be responsible and manage it. So I put it in kiddie pools, and I cover my kiddie pools over, and it's not going to go anywhere. And I also know that way I've got a clean source because both azolla and duckweed are used in remediation projects because they will actually absorb heavy metals and other yuck in the water. So you don't want to go to a wild source unless you know that wild source is clean and bring it over and start growing it.
Okay.
So I grow it in a clean source, and it's actually higher in nutrients than alfalfa.
Oh, wow. And
yeah. And so it's an incredibly, so it's great. It'll keep your chickens, all your farm fowl laying eggs. It'll actually help anything that you've got that would normally eat alfalfa. You can present it to any of your animals and they will eat it. And that's my go-to.
Okay. Well, I'm excited to try that. I think my ducks will be very appreciative as well as the chickens. So,
Yeah.
Awesome. Okay. I want to make sure that we get into the tree fodder. I'm very intrigued because we already do silvopasture here. I've got some different forested areas. So talk to me about how that works, the best types of trees for tree fodder. And then we'll get into like storing it for winter and all the different things. So
That is one an area that around here we've got an abundance of trees, and a lot of people when they're coming in and they're first wanting to move into their spot and they're planning out, I'm going to bring in a tractor and I'm just going to clear off the land and we're going to have pasture. Well, if you know that you actually already have a food resource there, not clearing off all those trees and looking at what you've got is actually going to help you in the long run. But in our area here, we've got ourselves some trees that will produce medicinal food for the animals. And I know we were talking originally about the possibility of some trees. You want to be careful how much you would feed your animals. But the trees, because they've got roots going down, they can actually pull up a lot of minerals. And tree hay, the leaves, actually have a concentration of minerals that any grass hay doesn't. And so really and truly, you are better off feeding your animals leaves and those kinds of things than if you had to choose. It's actually higher in nutrients than most meadow hay. It's incredible. So in terms of which kind of trees around here, we've got aspens and any kind of cottonwoods or birches. Those are all excellent trees for feeding your livestock. And in fact, of some of the trees that you can hear cautions about, willow is a caution tree, and the same with black locust, although that I'll go over what the advantage of having those are is. But the aspen and the birches and like cottonwood, you can actually feed those in volume to your animals with impunity. I mean, they're high in nutrients, but they are basically like feeding grass hay to your animals in terms of you don't have to worry about how much you're feeding them. There's not a lot of research that has been done in the western part of the United States on types of fodders, and it just isn't very popular out here yet. But in eastern part of the United States and over in Europe and actually in Australia and New Zealand, you'll find a lot of research that's done. So you have to really do some digging to find out what would be good and those kind of things. Well, my background is in forest resource management, and so this has really been intriguing to me to find out. And like you're doing your silvopasture management, that's so awesome. So if you happen to live in a place where you've got a lot of wetlands, really and truly you're sitting on a gold mine because you can actually easily grow willow. And willow is an excellent source of feed for your livestock, but there is one caution. It actually has some tannins in it that you want to be careful of. And if you don't want to cut the branches off and be storing that as your only source of feed for your animals, you want to feed them something else. You'll find that animals that have willow available to them, sheep, for instance, sheep like to graze there. They're a grazing animal. But if there's willow available to them, they will go to willow when they need to get rid of their parasitic load. And that's a natural way to get rid of parasites. So, hey, if for some reason we can't get to the store, the feed store, to get whatever it is to get rid of the parasite loads, you've got willow. That's the way to go. Let's back up a little bit and talk a little bit about the tree management, though, and then we can kind of go into the species. There's different ways of managing your trees, say in your civil pasture, or if you're going to plant them, so that they would be able to be used for your livestock. You can actually take, let's just use willow as an example. If you were to get a willow stick about an inch across, you can actually plug those branches in the ground in any place that's damp, and it will grow. Of course, you're going to need to protect that from the animals that you want to feed, because they will see it coming up and they're going to munch it. But once that tree grows up and has a stump that's about 1 to 3 inches in diameter, you can actually cut it off either down at the ground or up high. Cutting off near the ground is what's called coppicing. And what'll happen is, once you create that, you cut it off and you've got this little stump down here, the next year it's going to sprout a whole bunch of branches going basically straight up. And you can keep cutting that, and you can either cut and carry, that's your fodder, or you can cut and dry it, and by cutting those branches off and dry it and hang it upside down and store it and bring it in for tree hay. If you happen to have, say, an aspen that you see around your place, or birches or cottonwoods that are already, you know, maybe 3 to 5 inches tall, if you cut it off above browse height, so whatever you've got, if you've got sheep, of course, browse height's going to be shorter than if you've got cow or horses. So whatever, just cut it off above browse height, trying to get my hand in there. Then the next year, those branches are going to grow, sprout up from the tree, and you can let that grow, those branches that are going up grow. And by doing so, you're going to have a lot more leaf growth than you would if you just like reached up and cut down the tree a little bit. But every year you can cut off more of the branches. So you can actually, what you're doing is you're forcing it to produce branches that have a lot of leaves on it, is what you're doing. And then when you can go out in the forest, and so you can start converting your forest, your younger trees, into coppice trees that are going to produce leaf fodder for you, or leaf hay for you. So if you were to do that with willow, with aspen, with cottonwood, with birches, you're going to have yourself some top-notch feed available to you. Let's see, that one of them that's really highly nutritious is black locust, but there's some conflicting information about that, and all it has to do with is the timing that you would use the feed for. It's also called tree alfalfa because it is highly nutritious. It's got a higher protein than alfalfa itself does, but unfortunately, if you wait until later in the year to forage off of it, it concentrates its tannins, and it can actually be toxic to your animals. But the nice thing about black locust is that you can use that. It grows really, really good wood. So what you would want to do is grow it somewhere where it's not the only thing for your animals to forage, because animals that are used to foraging will forage what's good and tend to leave the other alone, as long as they've got stuff to eat. And then you can actually coppice it, or pollard it, and use the wood that it produces off on those offshoots. You can actually leave it and have it produce straight fence posts. Those fence posts will not rot.
Oh, okay.
So you've got yourself a really good useful plant in that terms, or it makes really great firewood. The BTUs that come off it are pretty good as well. So.
Okay, so I have to ask you about one other tree variety that we have a lot of here in northern western Washington, and that's maple.
Oh, maple's a good one.
Okay.
Maple is good. Now, there is a caution, though, for horses. And we don't have any here unless you've planted it, but red maple apparently is toxic. The leaves are toxic to horses.
Okay.
I mean, like, deadly toxic. And I wouldn't know that except for a neighbor when I was living in Western Washington told me about this, because I'm pretty new to horses. I can look at a horse and go, yeah, that's a horse. That's about as much as I know about horses. I'm learning. Maples are actually an excellent forage for animals. And they tend to actually like it. It's high in sugars. And a nice thing about a maple too, if you, any maple, a lot of people don't know this, any maple can actually be tapped for syrup.
Tapped.
And big leaf maple is, I don't know, do you have big leaf maple where you are?
Yeah, we have some maple? Big, well, we do have, we both, we have vine maple and we have big leaf maple. So is vine maple also a good tree fodder source?
Yes, any okay. of your maples can be used for fodder source. The one thing about maples, though, is that big leaf maple has a tendency to get heart rot real easily. So in terms of if you're going to be, you know, if you're going to try it, I wouldn't use it as a pollard tree, you know, and keep growing because it's going to get heart rot. But if you have a stump, the stumps tend to sprout. You just use those stump sprouts and they're going to be great as feed. But yeah, if you want to use big leaf maple in terms of a pollarded tree, as long as it's not somewhere where if it gets heart rot and falls, you don't want it next to your barn doing that, because if it does fall, that could be a disaster. But that's my experience with, from a forestry background, is that, big leaf maple has a tendency to get heart rot pretty easily.
Yeah. So as far as storing them for winter, so you said specifically the black locust and the willow, storing it dried and harvesting it later in the season, which you would then be drying it later in the season to store for winter, we can have a buildup of tannins, and it's not ideal. But for the other varieties, you're just drying them on the vine, on the branch, the leaves, and then storing them and then just bringing that out like you would hay throughout the winter as a supplement feed source?
You can actually, you can do it as a supplement feed source. I know some people worry about it being the sole feed source, but if you have to do the sole feed source, that actually used to be in Europe, was some of the only feed people had for their livestock. Now, granted, you know, we're not wanting to do the, you know, the starvation feed diet, but you know, it is, you can actually feed it as a sole source as long as you've got a variety there. It's like, you know, of different types of trees. I wouldn't do that with willow. I definitely wouldn't do that with willow. But what you do is when you cut your branches, if you have a place outside that you can hang them, you know, take your, if most farms have an abundance of baling twine, you know, but any kind of twine and bundle them together and then hang them over, you know, divide your bundle and hang it over a longer stick, and you can actually leave it outside and let it dry. Now, because we tend to be where it rains, you might want to dry it under a roof, but you could actually do not have to dry it before you store it. The one problem that I see a lot of people do, though, is they tend to, in Europe, I'm seeing this, and it just worries me that they actually will take their bundles and they'll stack them up, and then they put a tarp over the top of them. There's a couple of problems with that. Mold is a big issue. If you hang it, that doesn't seem to be a problem. The other one is mice. And you know, you read about, oh, well, it's no problem. You know, the mice will live in there, and you know, that's just gross. And so, you know, and why would you want to, you know, give yourself mouse habitat? I would hang it from the rafters in your barn. If you have a specific shed, you can actually even hang it outside, just drape a tarp over the top of it so that the snow sheds off of it, and you can just yank them down and tie them to your fence for your animals to feed off. But that, I did that last year as far as feeding our, I fed some to our, we brought a Highland cow in, and we had then an Angus. Now Highlands will naturally forage, but
yes,
I wasn't so
great.
Sure. They are excellent. But I wasn't so sure about our Angus. And now I'm not that up on cows, but I was really wondering if our little calf would figure it out. And I don't know if the Highland taught the calf to eat it or it just naturally did, but cows will forage. And I know that it's thought with sheep too, that sheep tend to be grazers, but those that are raised with forage teach their young to forage. So it may be a slow start if you're trying to teach your or present forage for your sheep, but they will catch on. And same with horse, goats, or grazers.
Yeah, yes, goats, sir. Yeah, and it's funny with the cows, actually, because we have intentionally tried to plant some trees in the pasture, and when they're young, if you don't have the cows out, like we've tried cages, we've tried fencing it, and they love any type of young tree. And so I tried to plant some pawpaws out in a section of the Silvo pasture. They completely got in and demolished the cages that I had around them trying to protect them. But it's funny because I've known that. And so known anytime we were trying to plant trees, we actually just have to take either hot wire it that area or just take the cows off while they're getting established until they can grow up enough. But it didn't really click with me, funnily enough, to use that as an intentional feed source.
Absolutely.
They were naturally going after it anyways. So it feels like a lot of things have clicked into place, which one would have think I would have made the natural distinction on my own, but apparently I didn't. So,
well, you're not thinking about in those lines. Yeah. You know, another good one to bring in is a mulberry. And in this area, in the northern regions here, if you get the Illinois Everbearing variety, it grows really, really well out in this region. And you've got an incredible nutrient source as far as the leaves are concerned. It grows incredibly fast, but you've also got the berries, which are good for human fare or animal fare. But same thing, you're going to have to protect it. But that's another really excellent feed that you won't have to worry about how much you're feeding your animals.
Okay, great. Well, this has actually been a plethora of information. We've really covered a lot. There's a lot of options. And I think this is great because as feed prices go up, and I know myself also, not necessarily in the moment that we're recording this, but there have been, you know, feed disruptions from droughts, like all different things. So the more options that we have available to us in order to feed our livestock for whatever the reason, I think is wholeheartedly the better, and better to start practicing these now and supplementing than waiting until it might be your only source, so that both you and your animals are used to them, have kind of went through some of the trial and errors through that. So Dee, thank you so much for coming on. I am super excited for your talk at conference. And for those who are wanting to really get into this more, where is the best place for people to connect with you now, other than the Modern Homesteading Conference in June?
Well, I'm working on our website still. It's partly up, but partly not up, but we're at Converse Star Ranch, WordPress.com. And also, if they want to just contact me via email at waconverse@yahoo.com. I'm going to be doing some classes coming up, and I actually do have a book that's going to be out by conference time on alternative sustainable feeds, but I will be doing classes too. So they look on Facebook for DeConverse, D-E, and then Converse. I'll be announcing it there, or through several of the homesteading homesteading Facebook groups too. So they'll be able to connect with me as far as classes are concerned, learn more.
Okay, great. Well, we will put in the blog post that accompanies this episode, we'll make sure and put those different resources listed there so people can be sure and stay connected. And thank you so much for coming on. I am excited to go get my mango beets and some turnips. Those are two that I'm going to be implementing right away. So thank you. Really appreciate your knowledge and sharing with us.
That's great. Thank you so much for having me. This has been a pleasure.
Hey guys, I hope you enjoyed that episode as much as I did, and I hope that we get to see you at the Modern Homesteading Conference. As I shared earlier in the year, we are going to be doing the podcast in seasons now, and so this is the season finale, if you will, and we are going to be taking a short break on producing new podcast episodes, but I will be back with you in April, so we'll be on break for about a month or so. I look forward to being with you back here then, and so for this short period of time, blessings and mason jars for now, my friends.